Before we get started with the episode, I have some exciting news to share with you all. I, Aaron Boyson, the host of Dietetics Digest, have been nominated for the 2021 CN Award for Social Media Personality of the Year. There is a link to the awards in the show notes, and I would really appreciate your vote. Thank you, and on with the episode.
Nothing quite like the buzz of being part of a busy ward environment, everybody getting on with their jobs, but working closely together and making sure, you know, that patients are safe and they're getting the treatment that they need. I really thrive in that environment, I felt. So it was, for me, it was exactly what I wanted to do rather than sitting at a desk, basically, for the majority of the day.
Welcome to the Dietetics Digest podcast with your host and dietitian, me, Aaron Boyson. Dietetics Digest is a podcast created and produced by dietitians for dietitians. We interview dietitians from around the world to talk about their journey and their groundbreaking work. This podcast will help inspire you and others to become the best dietitian possible. Sam Francis, welcome to the Dietetics Digest podcast. Sam Francis is a specialist stroke dietitian working at Bradford Teaching Hospitals. He recently actually started the role in NHS terms in the last couple of years, and he's really developed this new role as a specialist stroke dietitian in a place where there wasn't one previously. He recently published an article about his work in the CN magazine around his practice as a stroke dietitian and the extended role he's been able to do and the benefits it's had to patients, but also to the service as a whole. Is there anything I've missed there, Sam, to sort of introduce you as...
I don't think so, Aaron. That summarises what I've been up to quite nicely. So thank you for inviting me onto the show. It's a real pleasure.
No problem. I think especially since your CN magazine article and when you were able to sort of display the kind of things you've been doing and the kind of improvements in patient care, I think it really intrigued me. And I think a lot of people are also interested in this area, specifically the area about extending dietitians' roles and extending the role into placing nasogastric feeding tubes. But also, I know you do a few SIP tests as well to help support the nutrition of patients and help them be identified as at risk early so that stuff can be done a little bit about the nutrition. But maybe we could start a little bit early on, sort of a little bit of background of how you got first into dietetics, where your journey sort of started.
Yeah, absolutely. It's quite funny, really. It's in the office and in our team. So I seem to have had every single supporting role within a hospital leading up to becoming a registered dietitian. But my background originally was in sports science. I graduated in 2012 from the University of Salford, doing a degree in sports science. And I think it was kind of then that my interest in nutrition sparked, which I think is quite a typical story for a male dietitian, actually, is, you know, they come coming from a sports science sort of background. I was quite sporty myself growing up, but I sustained a few injuries and put quite a lot of weight on in my sort of later teenage years, and kind of got to a point where I thought I needed to pay a bit more attention to my health. And I think that's where the actual reading around nutrition sort of came to the fore and sparked my interest, so to speak. From there, I started to look at careers in nutrition. So I had a little look around. Obviously, there's loads of stuff on the NHS website. So, yeah, there's lots of things about being a nutritionist or a nutritionologist or a nutrition therapist and all of those types of things. It was really important for me to have a regulated profession. So obviously, that's where dietetics comes in. I then went on to do a postgrad certificate in human nutrition. The plan was to do a full master's in human nutrition at the University of Chester. Quickly found out that that would lead me probably no further on down the line than doing a degree in sports science with regards to actually getting my foot in the door anywhere. So I cut it short and just did the 60 credits and did human nutrition. I applied then for dietetics and I was unsuccessful on my first go, which was a little bit disheartening. So I decided that's not for me. I'm not going to do that because they don't want me on the course anyway. So definitely not something I want to do anymore. So I decided to take a job working as a pharmacy assistant. So I'd worked throughout my undergrad studies at a community pharmacy anyway. And I took a job as a pharmacy assistant at Withenshaw Hospital in Manchester. So I did that for a short period of time before a dietetic assistant job came up. I applied for that and I did that at Bolton for a good year. I was going to then apply for dietetics again, and I did, but a job came up for a marketing part of Lucozade Sport and decided to take that instead as the pay was quite good. So that was second attempt at getting into dietetics, abandoned by myself. I went traveling, that typical stuff, and then came back and worked as a respiratory assistant, so a therapy assistant for a couple of years as a band four, and then I eventually applied for dietetics again and was accepted on the course in 2016. So quite a long way around the houses there. But obviously then I did my 2 years. I did some training at Bradford, a B placement at Bradford. I really enjoyed it. And I kind of said to myself, this is where I'd like to work. And fortunately, there was a Band 5 opportunity when I was due to graduate. So I applied for that and was successful. So that was kind of the way around the country's way into dietetics, essentially. So that's kind of my way into dietetics.
Do you ever find that those previous, maybe they worked in clinical areas as a therapy assistant or previous jobs you've had outside of dietetics, help inform your dietetics today and your decisions around sort of understanding what other members of the team do and their goals? More than say just a sort of, what's it, sort of a cosmetic understanding that sometimes we try to do, like read a job description and try to empathize with the, not empathize, but try to see it from their point of view. Do you think that having those roles and being in that team helps you better understand their goals and their purpose, really?
Yeah, definitely. I think it was invaluable. It's funny because we try and work in a holistic manner and we say, oh, we're holistic practitioners and we like to see the holistic viewpoint. But actually, you know, how far does it go when it goes to actually how holistic are we? Do we have a true understanding or is it just a nice trigger word that people like to use on application forms? And I think sometimes you only know a certain amount by observing and sort of watching from far, but then pieces start to come together. And actually, how is that person involved in a patient's care if you've done that job yourself? And you start to see some of the challenges that other allied health professionals, other healthcare professionals or healthcare workers face because you sort of have done that before. So certainly gives me a level of, I can relate to it a little bit more and I'm more sensitive to the pressures, I think, for sort of other members of the MDT. And actually, you know, obviously I'm a dietitian and for me, my sole purpose is to sort of optimize the nutrition of my patients. But I think it's really important to have a true understanding of where other members of the MDT and other healthcare professionals sit and what their roles are and what you can do to help them and what they can do to help you, because ultimately that's where you get the best patient care and the best patient outcomes.
Is there anything that dietitians who haven't had that experience and are currently dietitians can get that experience without sort of quitting the job and becoming therapy assistants or working in different roles? Is there any way they can do that?
I would say just be proactive where you can, build relationships with other members on the ward, and if you don't work in a ward, other members of your MDT or, you know, any sort of healthcare professionals that you work quite closely with, and just express an interest to shadow, spend a bit of time with them, try and ask them to explain their role to you, and even have a conversation and say, how do you perceive my role and what I do, and how do we work linking together and see what their perceptions are, rather than, you know, guessing what you think their perceptions are. Is actually having that conversation, which sometimes can be a little bit daunting, especially if you're not really, you know, that familiar with the other members of your team. But if you kind of sell it as a, I really want to upskill myself so I understand what you do and best help support your role, no reason why people won't accommodate you, I don't think.
I think with every area, sometimes the plan can seem quite basic and quite simple, but obviously the journey to get there and why that's so crucial for the patient often gets missed, and talking to other therapists, actually understanding that. Because I think every job can be simplified into, oh, you just tell us how many mils you put down an NG tube, or you just tell me how many insert brand here supplement drinks that you need to put in, or you just get a patient to sit on the edge of the bed and write it in the notes and say you've achieved something. But actually understanding why they're doing that and what their process is, I think is crucial.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You came from a sports science background. That usually lends itself to more of a weight management or sort of a more community-based or a clinic-based role when you're talking to patients in clinic. Mm-hmm. What made you go for something so clinical as working on the ward on a busy stroke ward?
It's funny that, isn't it? As you say, because, you know, traditionally you do see people going from a sports science background more into more sort of either personal training style nutrition roles, exercise type nutrition roles, or if you exclude dietetics, more to do with weight management generally. But I think working as an assistant at Bolton Hospital, particularly as a dietetic assistant rather than any of the other assistant roles I've worked in, what I found really interesting from the get-go was reading medical notes and just having a little look through about, you know, what's going on with the patient, what's the diagnosis, what's the treatment, what medication are they on, what other people are involved in their care. And I was blown away by how interesting it is. And for me, the acute setting is the most ideal place to learn more about those, you know, really acute health problems that people are presenting with. So I just kind of wanted to get to know more and more and more about that field. And personally, I didn't think I would be able to do that if I went into sort of a weight management type role. And what I really loved about working on the wards was just how fast paced and hectic it was. Nothing quite like the buzz of being part of a busy ward environment, everybody getting on with their jobs, but working closely together and making sure, you know, that patients are safe and they're getting the treatment that they need. I really thrive in that environment, I felt. So it was, for me, it was exactly what I wanted to do rather than sitting at a desk, basically, for the majority of the day.
And that leads us into the recent role that you have, the extended role, which is a lot more physical than, say, most dietitians would. You actually get a bit more hands-on with patients than the average dietitian would.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that extends to placing nasogastric feeding tubes in patients. Now, could you just set us a scene, like, before your role was created, what was available? Like, what was standard care that was given to these patients, nutrition-wise?
So I first started working on the acute stroke ward at Bradford as a Band 5, so newly qualified, and it was part of a general Band 5 caseload. You kind of had a few different wards, a clinic every week, and you cover sort of community hospital wards as well. So quite a heavy amount of responsibility, and that would be part of sort of a bit of a rotational type basis. But with stroke unit being part of a Band 5 caseload, you couldn't really get stuck in. You kind of had to wait for the work to come in. And by waiting for the work, by work, I mean obviously patient referrals and things. And by waiting for that, people were getting missed, I thought, or there was delays in, you know, initiation of nutrition or getting people fed either orally or enterally sooner. So I've found that, to set a scene, if you're a patient coming onto the stroke ward, you just had a stroke in Bradford, you went into the hyperacute stroke unit, you wouldn't see a dietitian until someone else deemed it necessary for you to see a dietitian. And that's off the background of having not that much dietetic input. So therefore the culture to referral for dietitian wasn't necessarily that strong. Screening was slightly delayed because, again, the training, the culture wasn't really implemented, or it was, but just in dribs and drabs, as you could do as part of a very busy caseload. Because obviously, having done that myself, it is a very busy caseload. Having four or five inpatient acute wards, community hospitals, and a general clinic to juggle. It's almost, in hindsight, just gobsmacking that there was never a dedicated specialist stroke dietitian in the first place. And I think for me, that's what really stood out when I first started at Bradford, was like, why doesn't this exist? It's mind-blowing. And the amount of time that I would spend on Ward 6, the stroke unit ward, far exceeded anywhere else. And that's probably in part due to personal interest. But then also, once you start unpicking something, it just keeps going and keeps going and keeps going. And you think, wait a minute, why hasn't that person been seen, or that person, or that person? And you find yourself being overwhelmed by one ward. You know, to summarise, prior to this post that I do now, you probably would have less dietetic input, you'd have it later on. You might go quite a long time not being seen by a dietitian. You might not be identified as needing a dietitian soon enough, which ultimately, you know, will have a knock-on effect to your recovery and your rehab goals, essentially.
And I think it's also important to acknowledge, like you said, sometimes the culture wasn't there, but there was no dietitian there. I mean, everyone, it's a bit like a dietitian identifying therapy needs for a patient.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, a dietitian could definitely recognize certain therapy needs that a patient would need. However, they're not going to be anywhere near as good as, say, a physiotherapist or an occupational therapist at identifying those crucial needs that patient has.
Yeah.
And then implementing them. Or a speech and language therapist, we might notice that the patient's got dysphagia or is struggling to swallow, but a lot of dietitians, unless they've done external dysphagia training and become a dysphagia practitioner, they wouldn't be able to identify that as well as, say, a speech and language therapist. So I think definitely probably helps that you're a dietitian and that's your main focus on the ward. So while everyone's worrying about their area, you are there to worry about nutrition as well as other things too, but to work as part of the MDT. And I think as it comes up more, it becomes part of the, as you said, the culture starts to get implemented and it becomes more standard practice.
That's it. I think it's really boils down to you don't know what you don't know yet. And I think that's it. I don't think it's anybody's fault as such. I think it was just history, and it's not at the forefront of somebody's agenda if it's not being talked about very regularly. And it won't be talked about at a ward level particularly regularly if there's nobody there to talk about it, essentially.
Your role's not just a stroke dietitian. It's a little bit more than, say, the sort of a specialist stroke dietitian. Your role's been extended. Why did that need to happen? What was the purpose in that?
So there's a couple of reasons why, and there's a couple of thoughts as to why we should do this. We'd noticed quite a few occasions where referrals for patients were coming in 3, 4, 5+ days down the line where they'd been nil by mouth for a significant period of time and NGs hadn't been inserted. So we were thinking, you know, why aren't they being inserted? Is it because there's not that many people to do it? Is it because it's not deemed that important? You know, are people stretched and pressures elsewhere, meaning that they're not putting NGs in, or if they do come out, they're not putting them back in timely? And I've always been of the train of thought that I think upskilling yourself to do a job that would help the wider workforce is more productive than complaining about what's happening in the workforce over and over again and not actually changing any of the outcome. So that was kind of a personal push for why I wanted to do it. And then also the way that the post is by the my post is funded was that it came about by the closure of some beds, patient beds, which released some nursing fund money. So on the release of that nursing fund money, there was an opportunity to diversify the skill mix of the ward. And then some of that money was released for therapy, and some of it was released for pharmacy technicians, and some of it was released for a dietitian. So part of us taking that post on, there was an agreement with the ward, basically, and the general management that we'd need to help with the nursing type jobs on the ward. So we were thinking, okay, so what exactly is it that they do that we think we could do? And it's directly related to nutrition and dietetics. And it just light bulb moment, very obvious that, you know, if we upskill in passing NG tubes, nasal retention devices, and, you know, sit testing, and if necessary, hanging commencing feeds and general tube care and troubleshooting when it comes to, you know, enteral feeding, then that would save a lot of nursing time. And if someone was on the ward to do that, they wouldn't have to contact a nutrition nurse, wait for them to come back. Then I'm there then. Somebody's there, a dietitian is there to deal with all these nutritional related issues, essentially.
I think that definitely is a natural fit, because I remember I started off as a newly qualified dietitian, and I would get asked questions around the things you mentioned about tube care. Even said, can you place it to regards to the NG? And I was like, no, I can't. And it's almost like an automatic thing they suggest as a thing that you should do. It's almost like an obvious thing. Well, you could start them off then, and you should get them going, and you should. So I think it does. I think everyone else saw the fit there, especially in a place where they don't have nutrition nurses, because not every hospital has a dedicated nutrition nurse. Even, I mean, hospitals have multiple nutrition nurses, and some hospitals don't have any. Mm-hmm. And often a lot of that responsibility, informing the ward or different staff about care of enteral tubes, often falls on the dietitian.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
They don't always, aren't given always that specific training, because it's not really in their job role. However, I think, as you mentioned, we are sort of the go-to people for nutrition in especially in an acute setting. Why don't we know about some of these, especially sort of nutrition devices like at least NG tube? I know dietitians learn about it as they realize its usefulness, but I think there definitely could be more systematized knowledge around care of those things, especially for new dietitians.
Oh yeah, 100% agree with that. I think my level of confidence now troubleshooting NG PEG related issues is much better than it was when I was a newly qualified dietitian. And I remember being asked a question about somebody's NG tube when I was on a ward and being like, I have absolutely no idea. I'm not feeling confident to say, you know, try and do this or do that, or it might be because of this. And it just made me feel like a little bit like I was lacking in knowledge or expertise. And I always find it quite funny, because you write an enteral feed regime and then you give it to the ward and then that's it. But then you're associated with that whole process and that of feeding a patient and that whole side of their treatment. But actually, what we've done is write a feed regime, but we can't answer questions about the practical side of it, other than, you know, your typical tolerance issue type stuff, making sure people are fed at a certain angle. But if a tube's blocked, I wouldn't have known what to do. If a tube's moved by 2 centimeters, absolutely no idea what to do. The patient had been coughing, no idea what to do. And it's really nice now to be able to say, well, in this situation, try and do this, or actually I'll do this and sort this out for you. And ultimately that reduces delays in provision of nutrition, medication, hydration for that patient. And it's something that could be dragged out by having to ring a nutrition nurse to find out is actually streamlined and cut down because I'm on the ward there to deal with those issues. So,
or if you don't have a nutrition nurse, try to find some individual out there that knows how to deal with that problem.
Exactly.
As you've developed this role and as you've extended the role, is there anything else that's happened as part of this role apart from just placing the nasogastric feeding tubes?
So obviously with the doing the article for CN, we looked at quite a lot of key performance indicators and things to measure. So we based everything on the guidelines that are out there at the moment. So things from the Royal College of Physicians stroke guidelines, some of the Stroke Sentinel National Audit Program, the SNAP program, and looking at stroke NICE rehabilitation guidelines. And it was really to try and push timely screening. So that should be done within 24 hours. SIT testing, which I'll come back to, that should be done within 4 hours. And then consideration of NG insertions within 24 hours. Using nasal retention devices, bridles, if NG tubes are frequently dislodged, and more timely referral for gastrostomy placement if you're struggling either to keep NGs in or if patients are pushing to that sort of four-weekish sort of window of needing NGs and the swallow isn't looking like it's going to rehab. So really, we've tried to identify the need for dietetic intervention and intervene as fast as possible in the most effective way. So I think that was our real goal and aim for this service. And obviously that sort of shows in some of the things that we do, so the extended roles. I think with regards to SIP testing, generally it's done by stroke responders in our hospital. So they get alerted when someone's coming to A&E with a stroke and they'll go and try and SIP test them in 4 hours. But if there's staffing issues, if it's overnight or if it's a weekend or a patient isn't suitable for a SIP test because they're too drowsy, then they might pick up alertness, so GCS might improve 24 hours after that. They can be re-SIP tested, but on occasion there isn't anybody in on the ward or the hazu hyperacute bit that can SIP test somebody. So I can come on in the morning and generally I'll have a gander and a quick eyeball at the patients, who's new, who don't I know, who's nil by mouth, who is on a modified consistency diet. And if the patients are nil by mouth and they're alert, they're talking, they're sat up, they look like they're appropriate for a SIP test, I'll ask, is there anyone available to SIP test? And if there isn't, then I'll just do it because I'm competency trained to do that. And it's been two occasions this week, actually, where there have been patients that are sat nil by mouth. And again, linking it back to, our aim was to get nutrition implemented sooner rather than later. I asked them, are you happy for me to do a SIP test? They were, they passed, and then we got them drinking a cup of tea and having a bowl of Weetabix within 20 minutes of me coming onto the ward, where it could be hours later. And, you don't become malnourished in the space of 4 hours. What the patient's experience and quality of life and what is important to them is to be able to have a cup of tea or a bowl of Weetabix. And that's the thing that they'll remember, I think, is, being seen sooner and being able to get back to some form of normality despite being on a ward sooner rather than later. So for me, that's sometimes as important as looking at the more technical, scientific key performance indicators is actually how did the patient feel there and then.
Definitely. And I think if you add all those things up, sometimes the patients that have been in a long time are the most complex patients. Those experiences of either being nil by mouth for, we always talk about as dietitians, they've got procedures they have to go for being nil by mouth. They've got things they have to do being nil by mouth. They have a period where they're struggling to tolerate their feed or the food that's being given. And all of those experiences, if they are delayed or through staffing issues or through prioritization, then obviously that makes an impact on the patient, whether it's one acute event or they add up over time. And I think it's a really good thing for sort of expanding our scope of practice so we can support these patients and sort of say, well, it's a nutrition related thing. Mm-hmm. I'm trained in that area.
Yeah.
Let me sort it for you. Let me do that for you.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, I introduce myself as I'm Sam, I'm the stroke dietitian, and I'm here today to do a SIP test this morning, which, will hopefully enable you to start eating and drinking again normally. And then patients' eyes light up and it makes sense to them in their head. They're not thinking, wait a minute, why is this dietitian doing that? That's not something I expect them to do. But it fits in quite nicely with what our role is. So I think it makes complete sense, in my opinion.
Definitely. I think I really love the story that you gave. Is there any sort of experiences you've had where everything's sort of connected together or it's all sort of how would it work in practice? Say, do you mind if you just give us like a sort of like a case study or a patient gets admitted? How would that process go with you there as a stroke dietitian?
So I think, you know, there's been a number of times where I've come onto the ward. So I come in first thing, go to the office, you know, say hello, have a cup of tea, all of that stuff. And I go up to the ward generally around the time for ward round, the HASU ward round. So when people are sort of newly admitted with a stroke, they land there. And a lot of the time they're the ones that are new nil by miles and they, you know, they might be too drowsy for even a sit test or a swallow assessment. And it's not looking like they're going to become more alert anytime soon. So I go to the ward, you know, identify those patients, stand sort of to the side of the main bulk of people on ward round and, you know, interject where I think there might be a question. So, you know, this patient's nil by mouth. Is there a plan for nutrition at this point? And, you know, sometimes the consultant says, no, I don't think it's appropriate. And obviously you have to respect that medical decision. But sometimes I say, actually, yeah, no, I think you are right. We should start enteral feeding. I think that's a sensible thing to do. They go on to the next patient. I've, you know, built a relationship to a point with the consultants where I can just say, you know, are you happy for me to place an NG tube for this patient? Obviously ask patient's consent and things and do a capacity assessment if necessary. The consultant essentially now just rubber stamps it because he has that much sort of faith and trust in me as a part of his MDT. I'll just go off, get the stuff ready, insert an NG tube, and, you know, either myself or the nurse will hang the feed. And, you know, it goes from time to see no water on to time to initiating nutrition is probably half an hour, 45 minutes. That's probably as seamless as it's going to get. I think I'm not sure how I would optimize that process any further than I've tried to optimize it right now.
So the speed of delivery of nutrition is a lot faster than previously. And obviously that we could gather from that has an impact on patient outcomes, patients' life, not just sort of the length of time they stay, but how well their life is post-stroke as well.
Yeah, certainly. Well, all the majority of the evidence out there suggests, you know, that if you're malnourished, then you're at higher mortality risk. You're going to be in hospital for longer. You're going to have more risk of infections. And generally, your level of disability will be larger. So if we can prevent or treat malnutrition from the front door, then you will have an effect on treatment outcomes.
So you mentioned a little bit about you'll recognise if a patient's on a modified consistency diet or nil by mouth. Would you see those patients? How would you react to those patients? What would you say a patient's been deemed nil by mouth that morning? Would you go see that patient or how would that work?
Yeah, so, I mean, our referral criteria for stroke dietetic service is being nil by mouth, having a must of two or above, you know, which is similar to a lot of other dietetic services, and also anybody requiring a modified consistency diet, because there's strong evidence, you know, that your risk of malnutrition is higher if you're on a modified consistency diet. For patients that are nil by mouth, I'd usually introduce myself and just sort of make some comment or nod to the fact that they're nil by mouth and kind of just give them the reason why that they are, because I find that as somebody that's used services before, and somebody is obviously an observer of day-to-day, you know, practice on wards, is some things happen to patients and sometimes it's not always explained why that is the case. So people could be sat there, all it says on their board is NBM. So you layperson, what that doesn't mean anything at all. And they're not being told why they know by mouth sometimes, not always. And I feel like being a person that can, you know, explain that to somebody if they do understand and say, no, this is the reason why you know by mouth is because you've had a stroke and you've failed a sit test. This is what a sit test is. And at that point, I won't go all guns blazing and say, right, so I think we need to put an NG tube down. I'll say, you know, there's somebody else in the team that can come and assess your swallow and they're a speech and language therapist. And this is what their role is. And then the patient knows what to expect then. They know who's coming to see them next. And I've found that a lot of the time it calms people down and, you know, it gives them a bit of reassurance that they need. So it doesn't take hours. I don't have to do full referrals to myself on the electronic system and write up that whole conversation. I can literally just have a passing comment and say, you'll be seen by a speech and language therapist. If you pass, that's great. We can start you eating and drinking. If you fail and you need enteral feeding, then obviously I can come in then and do the next step of that as well. And they already know my face at that point. So when I come to see them again, I'm familiar. I'm not like, oh, like, wow, who's this person? I'm even more scared now.
Yeah, definitely. It helps to give them a little bit of knowledge and power in a time where they probably feel they're most vulnerable and powerless.
Absolutely. Empowering is a good word to use.
So you mentioned a little bit about how you built the relationship with the MDT and the consultant and things like that. How did you do that? Like, it's obviously been over a year, 2 years?
Yeah. About 18 months is kind of a nice...
So around 18 months. We've had 18 months to build this role. How have you done it? Is there anything unique that you've done or any sort of crucial, basically, tips and tricks, should we say?
Tips and tricks.
For the dietitians to use a clickbaity title. Tips for developing a great relationship with the other members of the MDT. Go.
Yeah, no pressure. I think having a presence on the ward is probably one of my number one tips or tricks, is be there and, you know, let people know who you are, what you do, and what you can do to help patients and also them, rather than, this is who I am, this is how you can help me. And just get to know people, introduce yourself, be friendly, try and relate to people on personal and professional levels where possible, and just be enthusiastic. Ultimately, you can't just think about things in terms of what is the dietetic outcome here. It's about thinking about what is the ultimate treatment aim for this patient. So medically, you know, therapy, socially, personally, all of those things, and where do we fit into that, thinking about the bigger picture. And, you know, I used the word before, in a holistic way, and that sort of really instills where you fit in a team into other people's minds. So I think that's really important. And for me, being around, being helpful, it has helped, particularly having an extended role, because you have an immediate impact from somebody's work within a team, which is, a patient required an NG tube. A patient now has one, thanks to our stroke dietitian, rather than a patient requires nutritional intervention. Hopefully they don't get malnourished later on. So you do get an immediate impact in that respect, which I think has helped quite a lot. I think that's it, unless you can think of anything else.
I mean, you mentioned about being present on the ward and things like that, and that's wonderful. And I think I obviously experienced being present and being on the ward. And I think as time's gone on, obviously with paper notes, it was really, really easy because we had to write up on the ward and we wrote in those paper notes. But often with electronic medical notes, I think sometimes it can be quite difficult for dietitians to be as present as they were before. Not in their presence as in them talking and relating to people on a personal and professional level, but they're actually just being a body on the ward, just sitting there, available to answer questions or bounce things off, like, should this patient be referred to you, or I'm having questions about this or X or Y. Do you think that has value, or do you think it's a waste of time? Or
I think there's a massive value to physically being present on a ward. I remember when I was a dietetic assistant, just working with a few different types of dietitians, and you get different types of healthcare professionals everywhere you go. And for whatever reason, there were some people that would go to a ward, stay on the ward, write up, and then do a lot of their work on the ward. And there were other people who come on, write as fast as they can, and then get off the ward. And it was like a flash. And the dietitian then was remembered as someone that just flits in and out of the ward. And I sort of vowed to myself then, all those years ago, that that wasn't the type of dietitian I was going to be. I wanted to be somebody that was very heavily ward-based and have a presence on the ward. It can be difficult logistically, if you don't have any mobile kit, getting computers on a ward and things like that when notes are electronic. So when we sort of started this post, it was one of my essential bits of criteria was to be able to have a laptop and remote work, essentially, and be able to go to a ward with a laptop and do everything from that laptop.
I mean, we made it possible with COVID now. I mean, that was before COVID affected us and made a lot of people work from home.
Mm.
Do you think it has enough benefit to make it worthwhile?
I think having a laptop has 100% the benefit to make it worthwhile. And I think the wider acute team that I work in has seen some of that benefit. And I think the majority, if not all of us now, have laptops. You know, it could be seen as duplication of electronic equipment because there are computers on wards. But, you know, anyone that's worked on a ward knows how difficult it is to get a computer sometimes. And it's very much this is my computer, you can't touch this computer, or this is a computer for the bay. And inevitably at that point, you're going to have to write your notes up somewhere else. But that then has a knock-on effect to the presence you have on the ward. And then, like you say, it reduces your ability to troubleshoot, answer questions for patients that are under your care, or any prospective referrals where people are concerned about the nutritional status of their patients. So it's made a massive, massive difference, I think.
And just almost being that sign there to make people go, oh,
yeah,
nutrition.
All the time.
Like just that constant little reminder.
All the time.
Little person sitting there over in wherever you sit,
so,
writing up notes. Because we all have to spend time writing up notes. You're just that constant reminder of, oh, when's that patient due for the must screen? When's this due? When's this due? When's my patient's been nil by mouth for how long?
Yeah, exactly. It's funny because there's a health scale on the ward who commonly will walk past and, as though he's accountable to me, will tell me, oh, I've done a food record chart for the chap in bed fine. And I'll say, oh, thanks for that. And he'll just carry on. Obviously, I've never expected that from him, but by being there, that's what he feels. You know, he's accountable to me, which, you know, ultimately it's still a better outcome for that patient because they're having their intake monitored properly.
Definitely, yeah. I think I'm going to ask you more philosophical questions. Do you think going forward, there's a benefit for more dietitians placing nasogastric feeding tubes? Do you think it's helpful? Do you think more dietitians should do it?
I think it's certainly helpful. I think, as with anything else, you need to sort of assess the clinical need for you to do that and whether there's a need to do it, because obviously, you know, a predominantly outpatient dietitian probably wouldn't need to train to place NG tubes. I say well, because it depends what outpatient service you work for, doesn't it?
But yeah, home enteral feeding, I think it goes
exactly.
Goes quite well. You can, you can obviously prevent admissions, and
that's something. Yeah, that's something that could definitely be looked at, I think, as a big developmental area in the future. Outpatient insertion of NG tubes for patients from a dietitian or another healthcare professional to prevent admissions for that patient. But yeah, I think if you look at the clinical need and is a quite a high prevalence of patients in an area that require enteral feeding, specifically, you know, nasogastric feeding or even nasogeginal, obviously there are people that are trained out there to place NJ tubes at bedside, then I think it's really worth at that point exploring competency-based training to insert those NJ tubes if you think that there's a need for it. I personally would recommend it if there's any punch that it might be beneficial for a patient. I'd say, you know, dietitians should look at trying to upskill in that area, because it's really, my development in the past 18 months as a result of doing that has been absolutely astronomical. Like, it's massive. My confidence for dealing with patients that are enterally fed, not just from a tolerance perspective, but the wider treatment, the wider enteral feeding treatment, is just much, much bigger. And I think I've shown in the article I've written, and, you know, it does have a knock-on effect to patient outcomes if you can be there to troubleshoot, initiate, become an expert in both nutrition and also roots of nutrition. It makes you a much more well-rounded dietitian, in my opinion.
So you said something there. I'm just going to pick on something you said. You said there's a clinical need. Now, your clinical need was it saves nursing time. That was correct, am I?
Not just that, though. Obviously, we needed to prove that in terms of the funding. So money's coming from nursing budget, so therefore we need to show that we're having a positive effect on saving nursing time. But the other clinical need is, you know, initiating nutrition early for patients that have had a stroke. And the evidence does suggest, you know, preventing malnutrition does have positive outcomes for those patients.
Which clinical area is that not a clinical need?
Well, there isn't, is there? I think if you had an established team that were inserting NG tubes really efficiently, dealing with any problems like straight away, and you felt, actually, I have absolutely no need to get involved in this because it's already a very, very good enteral feeding service, then at that point, maybe you could say, you know, there's no real need for me to upskill in that area at the moment. I guess what a big thing to consider is if you train to place NG tubes or anything like that and you can't keep up with your competencies, then you will become incompetent very quickly. So it's something that if you are going to train to do, that you kind of need to do it regularly to get good at it and then also become an expert in it, which I think you should be striving to become an expert in it if you want to start doing that in the first place.
Definitely. So in an area where enough NG tubes, you would insert enough NG tubes on your daily job role to enable to maintain a competency level so that you're safe to place NG tubes, because there's no point training, placing a few NG tubes, going, woo, taking a picture for social media, and then going, oh, I haven't placed one in a couple of months.
Absolutely.
Oh, I can't do it.
Absolutely. And you don't know what to do. And, you know, you need to be confident in doing it. We see patients with NG tubes all the time as dietitians, obviously, but there is actually quite a dangerous thing to do is to insert an NG and to start feeding down it. So if you're not confident when you're placing that tube, you could really put the patient at quite a high risk, really.
So you need to ensure that you're placing enough NG tubes that you remain competent. And I think there is, as you've mentioned, there's loads of different areas where, I mean, you're not the only dietitian in the UK that does this. There's multiple dietitians and they don't all work in stroke. There's so many different areas mm-hmm. where this would be a benefit to the wider MDT and supporting them, but also improving patient care and hopefully helping outcomes. So what kind of impact, what kind of outcomes have you actually measured during your implementation of the service, and what's been the areas that you've looked at?
Yeah, so one of the outcomes we wanted to measure was the amount of patients that were considered for NG tube within 24 hours, which falls in line with the Royal College of Physician guidelines for stroke. And at the start, we had pulled a load of patient data and we found that only 40% of patients were being considered for NG tube insertion. And then, 12 months into the post, it was up to 94%. So obviously not every one of those patients is going to have an NG tube for a variety of reasons, but statistically, more patients that require NG feeding will have an NG placed within 24 hours as it's been considered in the first instance. So that was a really important outcome measure for us. I think what we've proved is that we can initiate nutrition quicker for patients when you have somebody with an extended role, a dietitian with an extended role. But what we want to do next is to work out exactly what difference that makes to a patient. So looking at functional outcomes. Obviously, we look at anthropometry all the time, but being a bit more specific with that. So rather than looking at just BMI, looking at calf circumference, mid upper arm, maybe bioelectric impedance analysis, if that's appropriate, and seeing what a wider anthropometrical picture looks like when it comes to people's physical rehabilitation. So what goals have they been set or working towards with physio and occupational therapy, and, optimizing their nutritional status? What effect does that have on their functional and therapy goals and outcomes? And on the flip side of that, if somebody is struggling to maintain nutritional status for whatever reason, whether that's, not tolerating NG tubes, not tolerating oral nutrition support, losing weight, becoming weaker, does that have a negative effect on therapy-led goals and outcomes?
Have the MDT enjoyed you having there? Not just the consultant, but the other members of the MDT, so the nursing staff, and what's been their feeling behind it? Has anyone said, oh, you're stealing my job, I really want to place those NG tubes? Or...
No, not at all. It's been quite the opposite. It's been a massive help, I think. Both, actually physically taking the job in terms of inserting an NG tube. And then also part of now the development of this extended role is that I'm kind of the lead for training new doctors, new nurses on safe insertion of NG tubes and safe insertion of nasal retention devices on the ward. So it's really freed up time that otherwise might have been spent elsewhere. So it's been very well received. Even to a point, at one point, I kind of was like, listen, it's not just my job to put NG tubes in. So we're going to have to start looking at this. That's not all I'm here for.
Yeah, so in that situation where there's multiple patients needing an NG tube, it kind of got to a point where there was an expectation for me to put them all in. And it actually had to have a conversation then of, this isn't just my job. I still need to write mental feed plans. I still need to implement oral nutrition support. I still need to review all of the vast other things that we do as dietitians. So I'd sit down with some nurses and the doctors and say, there are 8 patients that need them. There are 4 bodies to do them. So let's do 2 each. And it becomes a bit more of a planning role as well as physically putting NG tubes in for patients. So that's kind of been the, the development and maturation of this role, really.
Brilliant. Have you got any tips for any dietitians interested in this area? How can they, what are the first steps they need to do?
So I think have a chat with your manager, supervisor, and sort of say, this is kind of what I want to do. Why do you think that it's something that you want to do and whether it's relevant in your area? And then if you've got a nutrition nursing team within the trust, then that's a fantastic resource to use. Absolutely nowhere to be doing what I'm doing now if it weren't for the competency framework that they'd already devised. Spend some time with them. See, observe as many NG insertions as you can. See actually if that is what you want to do, because some of them are quite traumatic, both for patients and for the people doing them. They're not always sort of nice and easy pictures that you see in the dietetics magazines and things like that. They're not particularly pleasant at times. So just making sure that it is something you want to do. And kind of ask yourself a question is why you actually want to do that. And then I think if it's a priority area for where you work, then sort of pursue it and go ahead with it. There are a few governance things you need to, little hoops that you need to jump through with clinical governance and things like that. But I think if there's a good enough clinical reason to do it and you can demonstrate that you'll have a big impact and you'll ultimately be better for the patient, then I think you'll absolutely pursue it, would be my advice.
Thank you. And I think I'd advise everyone to get the copy of that CN magazine, read the article, and understand more about Sam's role. And he's got some brilliant sort of numbers in there that you can look at and see the massive impact he's had on patients' outcome and how it's actually improved care and reduced costs in the wider MDT, and actually shown the impact dietitians can have when their role is extended in an intentional way, looking at the areas. And I just want to say nasogastric tube is not the only way that dietitians can extend their roles. So there's lots of other ways that dietitians can be flexible and learn to extend their roles. And hopefully we'll have some more of those on the podcast. I just want to thank Sam for his time, and that's it.
You're very welcome, Aaron. It's been a quite a pleasant way to spend my evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Dietetics Digest podcast. To share your thoughts on today's episode, please visit our social media. Our main channels are Instagram and Twitter. Also, if you enjoyed the podcast, why not leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or a podcast host of your choice? Or consider telling a friend about the podcast. Finally, make sure that you subscribe and follow the podcast so that you can stay up to date with our latest episodes.